Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Am I going to welcome students? But I don't know who they are. Thank you. Right, it's okay. Right. You're ahead of yourself by about 22 years. Welcome students with class program, which is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And when they accept the invitation, they've been given briefs, and they may do a variety of activities connected with the case. And then at lunchtime, they meet with a justice. So that's what the students are doing here. And we have students from Baraboo High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming today. Please be seated. And we have students from Boscobel High School. Would they stand? And thank you all for coming. And I recognize your instructor. Good seeing you. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Robensack. The classes will meet with her right after our second oral argument. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. And that's the lineup for the first oral argument today. 038P2865, The Warehouse 2 LLC versus the State of Wisconsin DOT. Arguing on behalf of Warehouse 2 is Alan Markovitz. Mr. Markovitz.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, guests. This is a very unusual case in that the only surprise to me as I got into this issue was the fact that this issue had never previously gotten to this particular point before this court. I'd like to begin by referring to what I consider to be a parallel to the situation we're dealing with here today. Because it is recognized by all litigants, lawyers, the courts, that when a condemnor in this state negotiates in good faith, but somehow understates the value by more than a margin of 15%. Our fee-shifting statute requires the condemnor to pay litigation expenses because, in the words of this court in the B. Frank case, the dual purposes in creating Section 3228.3d were to discourage inequitably low jurisdictional offers and to make the condemnee who has prevailed whole. As we inquire into 3228.3b, we respectfully submit to the court that the legislature had equivalent dual purposes in mind. The first was to discourage condemnors from initiating condemnation proceedings by issuing a jurisdictional offer when the condemnor had failed to discharge one or more of the fundamental prerequisites. The second purpose is a perfect match for the first analogy, and that is to make the condemnee who has prevailed whole. We look at this on a malfeasance scale, and we ask, is it not a greater wrong to fail to negotiate in good faith than to simply underestimate just compensation by 15%?
Counsel, can I just, on B. Frank, maybe this is my error, you're saying that that is the standard set in that. Would you just read, do you have the B. Frank there?
I do.
And that was the standard? Anything that's, if it's not within 15%, it's not in good faith?
No.
Maybe that's what.
What I was suggesting, Mr. Justice, is that it's helpful, perhaps, to look at analogies. What we're saying is when we have a condemnor, in this case we're talking about the state, which is the largest condemnor, when the state simply by error fails to get within 15%, the fee-shifting statute cuts in and says, you acted in good faith, you did all of the things you needed to do, you simply missed the mark by 15%. And under that relevant subsection of the fee-shifting statute, you have to pick up the litigation expenses. What we're saying is if you go to the B subsection instead of the D subsection, and you now compare the two situations, what we are suggesting is that where there has been an absence of good faith negotiation, that is a more serious offense to us than simply missing the mark by 15% or more.
Thank you. The legislature could have taken care of that.
We submit that the legislature did.
Under one.
Under subsection B.
B, okay. Under B, you say they did it. Does B encompass, how do you distinguish the case, which I can't pronounce, but I wrote in 78?
Resort.
Okay, how do you distinguish that? Let me put it this way. If that case came up today, would you decide it differently because of a change in the statute? Would you decide it differently because of, you think it was wrongly decided then? What would you do with it?
It's wonderful just for a moment to think of myself as having the power to make such a decision. We all aspire to other roles, and I might as well wear that mantle today. No, I would not make a different decision. I don't think Wieczorek is relegated to the wastebasket or should be relegated to the wastebasket. I think it needs to be limited. And I think what the court needs to do is to apply a more intense look at the nature of the alleged transgression that occurs. I am not at all uncomfortable in contemplating that if there is a technical omission, someone fails to dot an I or cross a T or fill in a blank in the jurisdictional offer, which under Klinker is the triggering event that starts the condemnation proceeding, that can be corrected, it should be corrected, and there need not be an imposition of litigation expenses as a penalty to the condemnor because they've made that kind of a mistake.
Would they have the same number, or could you have the same amount of expenses where there's this technical error as in your case?
No.
Why not?
Because there is a practical way in which the bar has dealt with the Wieczorek kind of situation. And this case presents probably the furthest I've ever been asked to go in this particular area or have gone myself in this particular area. What really happens in the world is As counsel, you receive the copy of the jurisdictional offer, your client brings it to you, and you look at it. And we're hypothesizing a Wieczorek-type error. Something is left out. There's a paragraph left out. There's a blank that's not filled in. There's a date omitted. As a practical matter, what happens in the real world is you either overlook it or you pick up the telephone and you call the other side and say, I just want to call to your attention that you forgot to fill in the date on which you're going to take possession of the property. Perhaps you want to amend your jurisdictional offer and we can move on without any of these difficulties. In this case, we had to ask ourselves those same questions when this fact situation developed. We first came to the conclusion that this was the most grievous omission that a condemnor can deal with. We went back to the cases which we've cited, and we've identified three fundamental prerequisites before a condemnation can go ahead. There's no way one can go ahead from a jurisdictional standpoint without the filing of a relocation order. There's no way one can go ahead without furnishing an appraisal. And the third thing which the case law requires is that there be good faith negotiation. Now, it's hard for me to even imagine a condemnor which would forget to file the relocation order, since that's totally under their control. And it's even hard for me to imagine that a condemnor would forget or fail to provide the appraisal that's required, whether it's a 3205 taking or a 3206 taking. But good faith negotiation, which is recognized by cases like Arrowhead as being such an important aspect of this, we consider those to be three of the items that have to be resolved because the cases say there is no jurisdiction to take the property unless you've done those things. In this case, we called to the attention of the condemnor immediately upon receipt of the jurisdictional offer that we believed that they had not negotiated in the required good faith. The choice then shifted to the Department of Transportation. They could have said, you know, maybe this doesn't really meet good faith, sending out an offer one day and then sending out the jurisdictional offer the next day. Let's solve this problem right now. Let's offer to sit down in good faith. We'll withdraw our jurisdictional offer. We'll have a good faith discussion. If that's successful, fine. If it isn't successful, now we'll issue the jurisdictional offer and we move ahead.
Yeah. Now, here you were about 300,000 apart, say, just, and then they raised theirs 20,000 and then sent out the jurisdictional letter, correct? Is that what?
What actually occurred in this case is they made the initial offer, which was the amount that was expressed in their appraisal.
Right.
They received the appraisal that was commissioned by the property owner, which indicated that there was a substantial difference of opinion and value. They then issued a second offer, which I believe raised it, and I think you're correct, by $20,000. And when that offer was not accepted, they went immediately to a jurisdictional offer. Anecdotally, I can say that that's not what occurred where after the court ruled that they had to go back and start all over again. That's not what occurred in the next round. But that's not necessarily in the record. But we made that point to the state, and the state chose to say, we don't care. We dare you to challenge this. And we, as I hope we always do, kept our word. We commenced the right to take challenge on jurisdictional grounds. The state had all kinds of opportunities to choose courses of action, but the course they chose was to contest the case. We wound up in a full-blown half-day trial in front of the circuit court in Winnebago County, at the end of which the court came to the bench and made the ruling with which you're familiar and said, This is not good faith negotiation. It is a jurisdictional prerequisite. Therefore, everything that you have done is void. Your award is void. Your jurisdictional offer is void. This taking is void. You have to go back and begin again.
Mr. Markovitz, what is the amount of the litigation expense that's at issue here?
I would guess from memory that the costs incurred by our client in pursuing just compensation in the trial court were probably somewhere around $10,000 or $12,000, something in that neighborhood. That number has increased, of course, as the matter has progressed through the Court of Appeals and to this court. But I want to come back, if I can, Chief, directly to your point. I believe that when the most fundamental right that the public owns, which is the right to be dealt with fairly by its government, which requires good faith negotiation, that we really only have two choices here. And this decision that this court will issue after due deliberation will send one of two different signals out to the condemning community, whether it's the state, whether it's the county, whether it's electric utilities, whether it's cities, whatever, renewal districts, redevelopment authorities, community development authorities. One is, if you don't negotiate in good faith, one of two things will occur. If you lose that case, and it's found that you haven't negotiated in good faith, all that will happen, and this is what the state is asking you to approve, all that will happen is you've got to go back and start all over again. There may even be a moment of embarrassment which will pass very quickly.
Mr. Markovitz, my theory is this. I throw this out for consideration. If the state or entity does not have the power to condemn for whatever reason, necessity doesn't fit, never will have the power. You win, period. Property owner keeps the property. Then your expenses incurred are a total loss to you and incurred by the state who has erred. Seriously. In the lack of a relocation order, in a lack of an appraisal, or in not in good faith, in all of those, the state can come again and seek your property. And the expenses you incurred, at least at the trial court level, relating to the appraisal and the amount of money, et cetera, you'd have to spend them again on the trial. And that's why, I mean, this is a theory that can explain B. That's why you shouldn't get those costs, because the state has the power to come at you again, and not all those costs are, quote, wasted, because in the new proceeding, you're going to be able to recoup some of them.
Let me add a couple more words to your question. You said the state can come again. I would add, and again, and again, and again. Mm-hmm. If they're never sanctioned for acting in what is the legal equivalent of bad faith, even the wisest, most well-represented property owner will eventually get the message that trying to force the state or a condemnor to act in good faith is just a waste of time, effort, and money. And now let me get to the money issue. If as a result of forcing the condemnor to negotiate in good faith results in good faith negotiation, the case may end right there because it may conclude with no litigation ever taking place. Or if the condemnee is still dissatisfied with the amount and appeals, they may be unable to break the 15% pane of glass and make themselves eligible to recover. I make no distinction in my mind between the condemnee forcing the condemnor to act in good faith as a means of pursuing just compensation as to get to the actual number itself. The message we are asking the court to send is, particularly in this post-Kelo era in which so much more attention seems to be focused on eminent domain and condemnation proceedings.
You're not denying that they had the power here. That hasn't come up.
We're saying they lacked the jurisdiction because
right. Okay.
They didn't negotiate in good faith.
You agree.
May I ask you, Mr. Markovitz?
Yes, sir.
Does the award of attorney's fees depend on 3228.3b, on these facts?
We believe that that is the correct interpretation of what the legislature had in mind, and I wish it had been written more clearly. I could easily be persuaded that reasonable people can differ about what this statute means. But
let me ask, on the Wieczorek facts,
right.
If they came up today and it was a new case, they would probably have to go under 3B as well, wouldn't they?
Yes, and as I responded before, I would say that that kind of technical omission, which simply requires the authorized, jurisdictionally based jurisdictional offer to be corrected, is not something for which a condemnor should pay litigation expenses. But if the condemnor has not filed a relocation order, has not furnished an appraisal, and most seriously of all, has not negotiated in good faith, the condemning community in this state needs to be told, not only are you going to have to go back and start all over again, but you are going to have to pay the cost, because this court has said on many occasions, one of the purposes of the whole fee-shifting statute, not sub B, not sub D, but 3228 itself, is to make the owner whole when the owner incurs litigation expenses in the pursuit of just compensation.
I understand the policy argument. And if, frankly, if we were just talking policy, I think I'd come up on your side. But we're talking statutory interpretation, 3B. And when there is a defect that deprives you can't go forward with a condemnation. How do you say, well, in one of those cases, you don't get attorney's fees, but in the other case, you do get attorney's fees, and it's the same statute, same subsection?
It's because, in my mind, I make a bright line distinction between a technical, clerical oversight and something which is jurisdictional. In Wieczorek, everything had been done correctly, except there was something left out in the jurisdictional offer. There was jurisdiction. There was no voiding. There was no washout of everything that went before. If the state doesn't negotiate in good faith, we are saying that that means you don't have the right to take the property. In Wieczorek, they had the right to take the property. All they had to do was fill in some date or some blank to get it done. If Wieczorek had never come up, I would probably be comfortable to argue even more extensively, but I don't see any reason to throw away a good decision that was made at the time, at a time before 3228 even existed. Now that we have the statute in effect, I think that Wieczorek can be limited to the kind of oversight
Let me ask you this. In Wieczorek, the Chief's opinion relies quite a bit or points to the federal statute. And I'm sure you are aware there is a case out of Louisiana under the federal statute that says negotiation in bad faith ain't going to get you attorney's fees.
Shame on Louisiana.
Well, it's a federal court system. Okay. How would you distinguish the federal law from our law?
Well, I believe that the reference to federal law in the Wisorek era was caused by the fact that we did not have either 3228 or a whole series of cases that have been decided under 3228. I respectfully submit that we need look no further than to our own statute and our own cases interpreting the purpose and intent of the statute. And I believe that the conclusion that you must come to is to say to the condemning community of Wisconsin, if you don't negotiate in good faith, you're going to have to pick up the cost, because we want that condemnee to be made whole, because this is just a way of pursuing just compensation. That's the purpose, the general purpose, and we think it fits specifically under this section. Now, if you don't do that, there's almost no instance in which the statute will ever apply. Because other than the extreme example of you just can't take the property, which is, in my respectful view, a bit of an oversimplification, because even if you can't take the property because the stated public purpose doesn't support the taking, there's nothing that stops the condemnor from doing a better job the next time and finding a better public purpose in taking the property. It's almost unknown that a condemnor which is moving to taking a particular piece of property is not going to wind up being able to take it eventually. We don't think the statute says permanently defeat, permanently deny the right to take, permanently end the matter. What we're saying is if it's voided, the award is voided, the jurisdictional offer is voided, the taking is voided, that constitutes a discharge of both the letter and the spirit that's behind 3228.3b.
Counsel, I understand what your argument is now. I mean, initially we had a lot of argument about degrees as you started your argument of malfeasance and sending messages to this corner and that corner of the state. And I sat here, as I think Justice Prosser did, as evinced by his question of, yeah, but this is a statute. Don't talk about policy. This is a statute. I see the issue is whether does the failure to negotiate in good faith, does it satisfy the statutory condition that the condemnor does not have the right to condemn part or all of the property? That's the statutory language. Do you see that as the issue in this case?
I see that as the central issue in the case, but in interpreting, if you find that the statute is not, as we believe it to be, absolutely clear on its face, and you need to get into resolution of an ambiguity because other people see the statute in another way. For example, my esteemed colleague here and the Department of Transportation see it another way. What I'm saying is if you get to the exercise of looking at how do we resolve this ambiguity, all these other issues, what's the policy, what's the purpose of this law?
Okay, but the issue is one of statutory construction, and you don't have much to the statute. We either have to define it as, if you want the money, the court determines that the condemnor does not have the right to condemn all or part of the property described in the jurisdictional offer. You either define that, or you come under, or there is no necessity for its taking. And as I understand it, you're not pursuing that. So your eggs are all in the basket of whether or not the failure, or alleged failure, not alleged, the failure to enter into good faith negotiations fulfills and satisfies that phrase in the statute. That's what this case is all about.
Is right on. Okay. And the reason I agree with you is because of what the court decided in the circuit court. The circuit court says you don't have a right to take this property. Your award is void. Your jurisdictional offer is void. You have to go back. They wiped out the right to take the property described in the jurisdictional offer. Thank you.
Mr. Witcher, Mr. Markowitz, in the W case, the statute, there was a statute And the statute was then numbered 32055, and the language was not right to condemn. The language was cannot condemn. And the case said cannot condemn means that you can never do it. Not that in this particular case you goofed and cannot condemn. It means permanent cannot condemn. That's the way it was interpreted. It doesn't have to be right, you know. I've wised up since 78. Don't feel compelled to...
A transcript of...
anyway.
I'm kidding. I
have another question, though, that's serious to me. Couldn't you have said, forget their not good faith negotiation. Let's just go ahead. The real issue here is money. So let's just go ahead and fight about what is the value of this property. Forget that I have the right to say bad faith, not bad faith, not good faith. And just go ahead and do it. Save yourself the costs. This is money. They're going to win on everything else. I'm not going to stall it. Let's go.
I'll give you the most honest answer I can.
Right.
I never worry about our clients, Chief. Our clients eventually will get just compensation. I worry about all those other people out there who don't have access to the same kind of counsel or don't go to counsel at all. And once we tell the condemnors of this state that you don't have to negotiate in good faith with people that you're coming to take property from, I can assure you they will stop negotiating in good faith.
So they go to court. That's not bad. We need the business. You don't have to answer that, Mr. Martin.
I really believe that my formulation is the one that the court would be more comfortable with.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Arguing on behalf of the Department of Transportation is Assistant Attorney General Pamela McGee. Ms. McGee.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Pamela McGee. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State Justice Department. And I'm representing this morning the hardworking employees of the Wisconsin Department of Justice and the people of the state of Wisconsin. Before I get started with my prepared remarks, since this is the only opportunity that I will have to address the Court, I would like to respond to a few things that were questioned of Mr. Markovitz and his answers thereto. With respect to the proceeding that occurred in the circuit court, this court does not have the benefit of the transcript with respect to what occurred there in that court, and therefore I am unable to present perhaps the different accusations or whatever that occurred there. What did occur there was indeed the circuit court concluded that this particular process had to start over again because we had not negotiated. Now, there's been a lot of talk about negotiating in good faith, and I would never claim that the department should not negotiate in good faith. However, I would like to point out that the statute actually says in 3205 sub 2A, negotiation, before making the jurisdictional offer provided in sub 3, the condemnor shall attempt to negotiate personally with the owner or one of the owners, etc. So, continually referring to the term good faith makes it sound like what we did was bad faith, and I would disagree with that. I would say, certainly, I would never claim that we should not negotiate in good faith.
What did you, I understand, and I just read Judge Carver's decision, but as I understand it, maybe you should tell me what happened in this case. Now, certainly, you had two appraisals. One was obviously much higher than the other. The state then came in with an increase of $20,000, and then there wasn't any negotiation. They just plunked in their jurisdictional offer, what, one day later?
I'm sorry?
One day later? What happened? After they increased their offer, the state, of $20,000, what did they do?
They did indeed do what you just said. They sent out a new offer. There was no attempt to negotiate at that point. And I don't disagree with that. And the court found that there was an error there.
No, he found, didn't he say?
Start over.
And that was in, it was not good faith negotiation, the court found.
He found that we failed to follow the statute by not negotiating in good faith. That's true. But I just wanted to point out that the actual language of what the statute requires is that we should attempt to negotiate before going forward. And I don't disagree that we did not do that. But another point that I would like to make here is that this was a mistake. It wasn't an effort to undermine the rights of the people of Wisconsin or of owners or whatever. It was a mistake. As I pointed out in my brief, and as you well know, building and improving highways is a very big and long-term undertaking. And there are many different things that have to happen before.
Counselor, I want to return you to the statute because,
okay,
in my view, what we have to decide is what does 3228.3b mean? And we all, I think, are pretty much in agreement on the facts of what occurred here. And for me, the question is, why shouldn't I interpret the words right to condemn in 3228.3b as having a temporal component to it? It doesn't say permanently the right to contend. Why shouldn't I interpret it as you did not have the right to condemn at that time because there was no jurisdiction to go forward? Why shouldn't I interpret a temporal component in that statute?
Well, I think that there's been a prior decision of this court, and let me just refer to that, in the Mitten case that has referred to that as the authority to take, if you don't have the authority to take the property.
I'm not concerned about the interpretation of the word right. I'm just concerned about when the right has to be in effect, just the time part of it, the temporal part of it. So that case doesn't help me any. It just tells me what right means. Well, I know what right means. What I'm wanting to know is at what period of time do you have to have it to fall within an award from the statute?
Are you referring to the time within which the owner must bring a right to action?
Well, I'm referring to the time that the legislature meant when they said, if you don't have the right to condemn, then you get attorney's fees. Well, at what period of time do you not have to have it? Do you not have to have it forevermore? There's never a right to condemn. Or do you not have to have it at a point in time? Here, opposing counsel said you didn't have jurisdiction, so at that point in time, you didn't have the right to condemn. Do you see what I'm looking at? I'm looking at, what did the legislature intend for the timing and the application of this particular phrase?
How long did it last, the right to take?
What I'm saying is,
I'm sorry,
does it have to be a permanent inability to take the property, or is an inability that is temporal but is later remedied so the ability to take can go forward? That's what I want to know. Is there a temporal requirement for the statute?
In order to prohibit
that? Ms. McGee, you'll have to stand in front of
the
microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Getting carried away there.
Yes, we're just talking to each other. It happens.
It's my understanding, what I would say to that is that in order to have to pay fees,
yep,
it would have to be permanently not able to exercise its ability to take.
Okay.
And I would like to say...
Why?
Because that's what the case law, the statute, I don't think the statute can be interpreted in any other way. Certainly, I think Zurich was interpreted, was written correctly. And I think the case law since that time has supported that position. I think there's been three different scenarios that can be put forth here that are supported by the case law. And the first one is, if there is no right to take or no necessity to take, you can't start over. The second one is, you've made a mistake in the process, but it doesn't make any difference whether it's jurisdictional or if it's non-jurisdictional, and I don't think there's been any differentiation here in the statute or in additional case law. The process is void. That's what happened here. The process is void, and we had to start over again, but we had the right to start over again because we had the right to take the property. The statute offers the Department of Transportation. Well, let me back up a little bit.
Is there a third alternative?
Beg your pardon?
Is there a third scenario or just those two?
Yes. If there's neither, sorry, if there's neither, if it's not a jurisdictional problem and if it's not something that actually prohibits the right to take, then you can go forward. And I believe the Bassinger case supports that. The defects involved the power of other administrative agencies, and no pamphlets were provided, those kinds of things. The court didn't make a start over. The court didn't prohibit us from going forward, period, in those
that's
cases.
That's sort of a harmless error kind
exactly.
of concept. Okay.
Exactly. Exactly.
Ms. McGee, I've got a question for you about Pechorek, because I want to narrow down the argument that I think the two of you disagree. I know the chief in Pechorek wrote that the court found the decision of the Court of Appeals in U.S. versus 4.18 acres of land to be persuasive in rendering its decision. And in describing that case, the chief wrote that a landowner is not entitled to attorney's fees under Section 304, where condemnation action brought by the United States is dismissed without prejudice because of a correctural procedural flaw. As I understand Ms. Markovitz's argument, he's arguing that this is not a correctable procedural flaw, but a different type of a flaw, fundamental flaw that deals with the basis of the proceeding. What is the state's position regarding whether there's a difference, and if so, whether or not it should control in this case?
I don't think the statute or the cases that have been decided after Wasorek have made any differentiation. I don't think there's any, I think it's clear there's nothing in the statute that makes a differentiation. And I think the three different scenarios that I pointed out that are supported by the case law reflect that there's no differentiation. And as a matter of fact, these are referred to as jurisdictional defects. When you say fundamental defects, that makes it sort of sound like it's a constitutional issue. But what the Constitution says is that fair compensation has to be paid when there's an eminent domain proceeding. And then the Constitution has allowed the legislature to prepare a statute which authorizes the Department of Transportation to exercise this, and we have to work inside that statute.
I understand it, but would you agree or disagree with the statement that a failure to negotiate in good faith, is that a correctable procedural flaw?
Well, I'm not sure I would refer to it as a procedural or fundamental flaw. It's a jurisdictional flaw, which means that had to go back and start over again.
But the answer is it is correctable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And before I go any further, I want to point out also, I'd like to point out if I could, the fact that this fee-shifting statute is not the only remedy that would keep departmental employees from trying to take away the rights of the owner, which I would certainly deny that that's what happens. I think there's mistakes that were unintended, those kinds of things. But if you go back and have to start over again, you're talking about a lot of time involved in starting over with an acquisition.
Counselor, isn't the purpose of the condemnation chapter as a whole to require that the state, when it exercises its power to condemn, fairly compensates the landowner for property that they don't happen to want to give up, but are forced to give up?
I would absolutely admit that, and I am here today to say that I think that we recognize that this is a really awesome power.
Well, when they exercise that power, counsel on the other side tells us that his client spent $10,000 to $12,000 to get the state to proceed properly. So if you paid them just compensation for the property, they'd still be $10,000 to $12,000 short if they don't get paid for their attorney's fees, wouldn't they?
Well, I think that the statute cannot be interpreted to reflect that it is necessary to pay those fees because of the three scenarios that I set forth earlier. And indeed, the property owner has chosen to go through this process. He still has the process of going to get fair compensation if the right to take action is not brought. And in reality, what has the owner obtained? He's back in the same place that he was to begin with, and we have to start the process all over again, which can cost the state a whole lot of money.
But it's the state's fault that you're back at square one. It's not the landowner's fault.
I don't disagree with that.
Counsel, if I may, with regard to Justice Wilcox started this questioning, looking at the decision of the circuit court, and I want to really keep with the statute and forget about all public policy. I want to interpret this statute. It seemed, and I note by the circuit court's decision, when it was addressing the issue of the good faith bargaining, it didn't refer to money at all. The money is not before us in a legal sense, I think, in the interpretation of the statute. As I read the trial court's decision, there is a lack or an absence of good faith bargaining because there was no contact. That's what the court says. There was no contact. A letter was sent, no response. Another letter was sent with an offer, then the jurisdictional offer was sent, as I understand it. And the circuit court doesn't mention, you know, is it 400,000 enough? Is 600,000 enough? Rather, the circuit court says it's the procedure. There was no contact. That's why there is no showing of good faith negotiations. It seems to me that under that process of analysis, that the state could have, let's say the property owner wants $700,000. The state could have sent a letter offering $650,000. No response. Sent another letter with $690,000, and then the next day sent the jurisdictional offer of $690,000. That procedure would manifest an absence of good faith negotiations. Would it or would it not?
The scenario that you just painted? Well, as I said earlier, the record of what occurred previous to this particular action is not part of the record before the...
That's not my point. I'm not making myself clear. This is... let's see. I'll try one more time, and if it doesn't work...
Shame on me.
I want to take a look at the circuit court's decision. The circuit court, in paragraphs of its opinion, sets out dates that letters were sent, but doesn't even mention money. And in paragraph 6, says, without any other contact. And so it seems to me the absence of good faith negotiation in the circuit court's determination has nothing to do with money because no money was referenced, but rather has to do with whether or not they came together and had contact, or it was just sending letter, sending offer.
So?
Are you saying came together personally and had contact?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the statute that requires negotiation requires that it be face-to-face contact. It requires an attempt to negotiate. What that actually might mean, it could mean, you know, telephone calls. It could mean letters sent back and forth those kinds of things.
Could I ask you, isn't it true that 3228 was created after the Wisorek
decision was decided.
The new language of that, yes. It brought together various, from various other parts of the statutes, the payment provisions, yes.
And isn't it true that the language in 3228, particularly 3B, is really quite different from the language in the federal statute that so heavily influenced the Wasorek case?
Well, I would have to say that I don't think it's that different in terms of how it's been looked at since that time. The term cannot condemn versus right to condemn has been looked at as the authority, whether we had the authority to condemn one way or the other. And I think our statute that the subsequent cases to Wasorek have been right on in terms of interpreting it in that way. I think it's been clearly referred to as being interchangeable, those terms.
If the federal statute uses the term final judgment.
I'm sorry?
The federal statute uses the term final judgment, which is not, I don't think that's included in 3B. I mean, I don't think you would. You'd have to read something into 3B to get an equivalent concept.
Well, I have to say that I would have to rely on the cases that have been decided since that time, and they have not indicated that there's anything different about the underlying policy, the underlying legislative intent, and indeed the underlying purpose of the statutory right to fees and costs in some circumstances and not in other circumstances.
But in all these cases, there was a final judgment. The final judgment was to throw the state out of court. Didn't you get thrown out of court here?
We did get thrown out of court, but we
And you had to start again. But there was a final judgment. You could appeal it to the Court of Appeals. There was a final judgment in the W case. They could appeal it to the Court of Appeals.
That's correct.
And if there wasn't a final judgment, you wouldn't be here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there has to be a final judgment to get here under 3208. And in the W case, the court wrote brilliantly, this limited legislative history appears to support the city's contention that the phrase, quote, cannot condemn, which was that statutory language, means, quote, has no right to condemn. And when they redid the statutes, the words has no right to condemn doesn't appear, nor do the words cannot condemn. But it now says does not have the right to condemn, which is the language the court used in the W case. And in the federal statute, it says the final judgment is that the federal agency cannot acquire the real property. So the question here is whether, and that was cannot condemn was the language, and that's why it was used in that case, but it still doesn't answer the question whether or not the W case is correct and is good interpretation of the statute.
And I see no reason why to determine in any other way that it was not correct in spite of any change in the specific wording, considering that we're talking about the term that's been used, for example, in the Mitten case, the authority, which is what both statutes would have referred to.
I know, but the Mitten case says what you say it says, but the issue in the Mitten case was not, how do you describe that, define that statute. In the Mitten case, the question is whether they had the right.
That's true.
And the court said, I think they said it didn't have the right to take all of five. So it doesn't really answer the question in this case. I mean, it helps you a little, but it is not directly on point. Do you agree with that?
Well, certainly it's not few cases are actually directly on point with other cases, unfortunately. But I certainly would say that the Rexorick case has continued to be the guiding light for developing these other three scenarios that I believe that I referred to earlier, and that the statute continues to reflect the fact that there has to be no authority to take, if you look at what the term right to take means. And so I would certainly say that that case, plus the subsequent cases, plus the circuit court and the court of appeals, have all been correct in relying thereon.
Assuming that your mistake of failing to negotiate in good faith, and you agree there was a mistake.
Absolutely.
And you're not fighting the termination of that proceeding. You're fighting only the costs, as I understand.
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So assuming that there was a mistake, and assuming that it was a mistake that shouldn't have been made, and the court, circuit court is right, that is, in dismissing, how do we, and I say we, under the statute, compensate the poor, unfortunate condemnee? I mean, they're out money, right? We don't deny they're out money. They've fought you all the way up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They're out a fair amount of money, at least $12,000, as I understand it, and then some. And it's sort of, quote, wasted, because even if they get $600,000, let's say the property's worth $600,000, they're really not getting $600,000. They're getting, assuming the costs are $20,000, they're getting $580,000, right? For a wasted proceeding. So despite the concentration on the statute, how you want to interpret a statute so it makes sense. That's good statutory interpretation. And not have absurd results, right?
Correct.
And fit with the policy of the legislature.
Yes.
So how do we do that where you have a situation like this one?
Well, I would have to respond by saying not every proceeding is necessarily going to be subject to a fee-shifting statute. And I think apart from the statute, there are definitely policy reasons for that, for the legislature having failed to specifically point out, for example, using language that says every time there's a proceeding that's brought prior to the acquisition that the department hasn't complied with some port, the statute's going to provide fee shifting. That's not what it says. It's limited. And so I would have to say that it would be the legislature that would give the power and authority to do that. And it hasn't done that here.
Could I ask, Mr. Markovitz creates the picture that if the Department of Transportation wins here, really the condemnors will have open season for bad faith negotiations without penalty. How do you answer that?
Well, first of all, I don't like starting out with the supposition that the condemnors and the people who work so hard at the Department of Transportation are out to undermine the rights of the owners. I work in this area all the time, and I know that they often bend over backwards to attempt to make the owner whole. So I don't accept that initial proposition. Secondly, again, I would say that the statute doesn't permit it, as I just argued. And thirdly, I would say that there are other curbs and sanctions, which involve a big loss of money to the state if we can't stay on the timetable of the bids and so forth that have to go in and the acquisitions have to take place. If we have to go back and start over again, it's going to cost a lot of money, and obviously the state employees who are involved with that are not going to want to put the department in a position to have to deal with that because they made an error or a mistake. That's just not something that they're going to want to do. So there are other curbs and sanctions that occur if we have to go back and start over again. And I believe that if the legislature had intended that every single thing require going back that or require fees when the owner prevails in a situation like this, they would have said that. And I do believe, on the other hand, as opposed to having the poor landowner being undercut by the department employees, it will initiate a flood of litigation. I'm sure perhaps you are aware that other states around us do not have a fee-shifting policy at all, and certainly that is something that drives the engine of litigation in this particular area. And I think that the sanctions involved in the overall approach to trying to get the project in on schedule are significant. And again, I don't think the legislature intended, if they had intended to do it, they would have spelled it out more.
Can I ask one other sort of couple factual questions?
Sure.
Unless I am mistaken, neither party cited any, in the briefs, any figures of what was in the jurisdictional offer or what was in the appraisals, and it wasn't completely clear to me exactly what the status of this property is. Is that just irrelevant to this or not?
The present status of the property, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we had to go back and start over again. And just as was required by the court and by what I believe to be the existing law. And we did acquire the property, and indeed the owner is now pursuing his right to seek just compensation by having brought a lawsuit under that statute for additional compensation this second time around, and it's scheduled for trial the 1st of November.
So
I think I've...
let me, if I might, ask you a question that's bothering me, and this is my simple-minded approach, okay?
I got it, too.
When I look at 32055, it says court actions to contest right of condemnation, and it's clear reading the language in that particular section, that indeed that's what's at issue, the right to condemn. That's the action, as I understand it, that was brought before the Winnebago County Circuit Court.
Correct.
The court determined there was not a right to condemn. And 3228.3b seems to say that under those circumstances, you get your litigation expenses. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think perhaps the language was not as careful as it could have been in the circuit court's decision. And I believe that what the transcript and the proceedings and so forth would show that he agreed, that he said that this is not being decided on the merits of whether there was a right to take or a necessity to take. And but indeed there had been a situation where we had made a mistake, we had attempted to negotiate, therefore we had to start the process again.
But if you look at the language of the statute, and we're interpreting the statutes, don't we have to look at the nature of the action that was brought before the circuit court, the determination made by the circuit court, and whether or not the court found there was not a right to condemn? And the statute says if the court determines that the condemnor does not have the right to condemn, you get your litigation expenses.
I would submit that the court intended to say that the jurisdictional, the department no longer has the jurisdiction to continue with this particular proceeding, because I think that's indeed what has happened here, and that would be my response to your question, Your Honor.
The court didn't say that. I mean, you're saying what the court intended to say?
Well, I'm saying that there's a transcript here that's not that's not in the before the court this morning. And also, I believe there is a reflection in the court's order that does say this is not being decided on the merits.
The state did not have the right to condemn under these defective proceedings. Isn't that correct?
We were not permitted to actually acquire the property, but that didn't mean we didn't have the authority to condemn.
If you did it right.
Correct.
So the question under 32055 is, the words mean no right to condemn under this proceeding.
right? Or does it mean no right to condemn ever?
Under this proceeding, I would certainly say.
Okay. And then the question is, under 3B, no right to condemn, does it mean under this proceeding, or does it mean ever?
I think it means what Ms. Zurich refers to, cannot condemn, no authority to condemn,
ever.
No right to ever
under
condemn.
These, okay.
Correct.
And that's how you're reading these two statutes, which may or may not be what the court says.
Yes.
But thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Markovitz.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. I want to talk just a minute about mistake. First, I think it's a mistake to suggest to this court that a separate decision made by the Circuit Court of Winnebago County, which was never appealed and of which there was a right to appeal, is somehow back before this court for the court to look behind what Judge Carver decided when he made that decision. The second mistake that I want to talk about is counsel characterizes this failure to negotiate in good faith as a mistake. The record in this case, indicates that we contemplated that that was a possibility. That's why we wrote immediately upon the receipt of the jurisdictional offer to the state and said, you haven't negotiated in good faith as required by the rules. The response of the department was not to say, oh, we made a mistake, we're sorry, let's sit down and do that tomorrow or next week, and then we'll proceed. No. What they did was they issued the award and they took the property, and then when they were challenged within the 40-day period under 32055 with the right to take challenge, they resisted it all the way through a contested proceeding before Judge Carver. They gambled that they would get off the hook. And then they gambled again about payment of fees. I want to quote only one thing from Judge Carver's conclusions of law. And it's paragraph 2, and it's in the appendix at page 106. And I quote, because required good faith negotiations are a jurisdictional prerequisite to the exercise of eminent domain power under Section 3205 stats, the absence of such negotiations causes the jurisdictional offer and all actions undertaken thereafter by defendant, including the award of damages, to be null and void. I don't know any more definitive thing that the judge could have said at that particular point in time. The last thing I want to say to me, when someone says, you cannot take my property, it is different than saying you don't have the current right. You don't have the right to take my property now. This whole business of is it permanent, is it temporary, I agree with Justice Crooks. You have to look at the remedy in relationship to the right that was being exercised under 32055. Under that statute, that's the only time and the only opportunity. We have numerous cases which say if you sleep on that 40-day right, as happened in one of the cases we cited where the court said, the fact that the other side admitted they didn't negotiate in good faith has gone by the boards because they didn't take timely action within the 40-day period. To me, it is clear on the face of the statute. If you challenge them and you succeed, and they have to go back and start all over again with something as fundamental. We're not here arguing about a small omission. We're talking about a fundamental prerequisite. They were wiped out. They chose to start again. If they hadn't started again, this property owner would still own the property to this day. What could be more final than changing the status from you own it to you don't own it? I respectfully submit that in this particular set of circumstances, in order for this condemnee to be made whole, he has to be reimbursed for his cost of pursuing the means to obtain just compensation.
Counsel, you have time yet. I have a question.
I have a question. You have.
Let's say your client wanted $700,000 because you're talking about right and remedy. And same procedure happened here, two letters and jurisdictional offer, no contacting the owner in terms of personal, you know, good faith negotiations. And they, the state, in letter, without contact, offered you $650,000 the first time and $680,000 the second time, without entering into the good faith negotiations, just letter, letter, letter. Do you think your remedy, and they didn't enter into good faith negotiations because they just sent two letters and a jurisdictional offer. Do you think in those circumstances where the amount is $20,000 less than what you really wanted, that you should be entitled to a remedy of litigation costs?
I have difficulty with the hypothesis because if my appraiser tells my client the property is worth $700,000 and the state sends me an offer for $680,000, none of us are standing here or sitting here today. To complete the record, since counsel referred to it, when they went back and started again and there were good faith negotiations, the amount that resulted in payment at the end of those good faith negotiations was none of the numbers you've previously heard. The reason for good faith negotiation is to level the playing field and give that condemnee an opportunity to that kind of a dialogue with the state, even without having to go retain counsel.
Thank you.
You're still in litigation.
Excuse me?
There's still litigation on this.
Counsel is correct. To the best of my knowledge, there is a case that is pending jury trial in Winnebago County that is scheduled for sometime next month.
I have a question for you because of my lack of knowledge in this area. Under 3B, it says the court determines that the condemnor does not have the authority to condemn. Now, let us just assume that the state is right. That means never has the power to condemn this. Okay? I know that's not your position, but let's assume that. Mm-hmm. Then it says, or there is no necessity for its taking. Are those two different concepts?
Yes, they are. They are completely different concepts.
Good. That's what I wanted
someday
to know.
Someday maybe we'll have a case before the court in which we'll be arguing based on the alternative conjunctive.
Right, because it looked to me, if you accepted the state's argument, there were two different concepts, and if there weren't, of course, then that's an argument against the state. Thank you. That concludes our argument in 03AP2865, the Warehouse 2 versus State of Wisconsin Department of Transportation. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Mr. Markovitz and Ms. McGee for excellent arguments today that have been very instructive on a statutory interpretation issue. Thank you. We'll take a few minutes in recess so that